This is continuing with Gordon Stanley on 12 August 1981 at Ersey. We were discussing the fact that you said that John Bolton asked you to come with him to Caltech, and the whole business of the Parks Dish came up, and apparently you were that happened even before you left, that there was discussion about what should be the big step. Can you tell me about
I felt that was another thing that influenced my decision to go to California. Although I really stood outside the whole business as an observer more than anything else. Essentially, this thing had gone on ever since the time when I mentioned earlier in the discussion at the end of the war when Britain left and Joe didn't want the job as head of the laboratory, mm-hmm. and Taffy took over. And there was always that undercurrent of almost animosity, I think, between the two men. There was very little question about the division of loyalties within the laboratory, though. The laboratory was almost solidly 100% on Joe's side, and against Taffy. I've always, though, had an admiration, you know, strange sort of an admiration, I suppose, what somebody else called a fearful sort of admiration for Taffy. And I understand men like that very well. He actually seemed to thrive on that sort of opposition.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of proposals on, well, essentially the two groups were divided into those who believed in a large array, not specifically defined, really, and people who believed in a large dish. The large array, of course, was Joe's side. Although one of the ideas conceived on Joe's side was an Arecibo type dish, mm-hmm. But that I think was largely abandoned because of the virtual impossibility of finding sites which were geologically stable enough in New South mm-hmm. Wales. At least that was the reason given.
Mm-hmm.
I find it a little hard to believe now in retrospect because the Arecibo site looks a lot more geologically unstable than anything you'd find in New South Wales.
Yeah.
However, the array was probably to have been a Mills Cross type of device, and I think at that time I would have supported it, but in retrospect, against to show how poor your judgment is, it would have been obvious that we would have been better to have gone the way that we did in California, which was a two-element paraboloid type mm-hmm. system. But I only convinced myself of that when I got to California. As I said, I had somewhat of an admiration for Taffy because I had very little doubt how the final result would come out, because you'd never want to underestimate Taffy. I always consistently tended to underestimate what he would do myself, and I did say to somebody shortly before I left, I said, I'd take a bet that he eliminates every part of that opposition, and that's what he did. Mm-hmm. He isolated people one by one, in effect, until Joe was left, in effect, with no effective support.
Mm.
And I don't think it's pertinent for me to go through the people one by one, but he picked really on flaws in their background and character and things like that, I think. If anybody planned anything, you asked me if things were planned at Radio Physics, I think that was planned.
That was planned.
I think it was one of the most beautiful pieces of Machiavellian politics that I've seen. It was the best I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Although the end part of the story didn't come until I was in the United States.
I didn't talk to Joe about it
until he came to stay with us and stayed for a while. And I remember our youngest daughter was very young then, and Joe was sick and didn't know about it. And the little girl was running around all over the house, and Joe's, I wish I had that sort of energy left. He thought he'd had mononucleosis or something mm-hmm. like that.
This was in 61 or yeah. something now, yeah. yeah. Much
that
later.
That
yeah.
was much later. Yeah. So the final stages were written after I got him. But I really think also in retrospect that the large dish was a better decision than the Mills Cross, and I think history has vindicated Taffy on that part of it, although he probably could have spent the money in a better way.
Yeah.
And in some ways I made the same mistake myself on the when I was on the advisory committee at Greenbank, and they were having such terrible trouble with 140 foot because of rather bad financial arrangements, and I said at a committee meeting once that they should abandon the whole project because for another $2 million they could build a much more effective telescope. I may have been right, but on the other hand, the 140 foot proved itself to be a very fine instrument.
Yeah. You were thinking of something, a completely different design, Altaz probably.
Yes, right. Larger, less accurate.
Yeah. So really, it does boil down to big dish versus array.
Yes.
Now, you're talking now about before you left, even, 53
yes.
to 55.
Oh, yes, it was...
I mean, well before
Christensen and Mills. The decision was part of the decision to go ahead with the initial Mills Cross and then the later extension of the Mills Cross out at Fleurs. I mean, the fact that the interferometer that we were to build at Jarvis Bay was abandoned and not to be funded, it was part of the whole story. So it goes, way back. As soon as
your interferometer was in conflict with Mills's first or Mills's Big Cross and Fleurs.
Yes, well, right. In that respect, you have to say that, in fairness now to Joe on these decisions, that I said earlier that there didn't seem to be any planning, and there wasn't any planning in the early years, but maybe it was reasonable not to have any planning then, because the projects financially were not a great burden.
Mm-hmm.
And
in the field,
now
so young,
we'd reached a peak, and it was the decision of whether to build a bigger, more effective instrument. Which instrument did you build?
Mm-hmm.
To maintain your reputation, to keep the place alive.
Right, right.
I think Taffy made the better decision, actually.
There was no idea of any Earth rotation synthesis or anything like that with the two cylindrical paraboloids.
No, what
was proposing with it?
Well, that was sheer luck. At the Arns Valley too, there was no thought of synthesis when that was built.
Yeah.
The spacings are actually wrong, and
are not ideal for
not ideal.
Yeah. Okay, so Christensen and Mills leaving later is really a second whole episode. I mean, it's
right.
not related to this. First thing, or is it, would you say it is related?
Well, I can tell you specifically, it is related. Chris, I don't think I'm betraying any confidence. This thing should be, I think it's history and it should be written down. Chris wrote a letter to Oliphant.
Whose position was what?
He was head of the Australian National University and a very important man.
Mm-hmm.
And said Taffy is incompetent in effect. And I was telling this story to Bob Barker, who was provost at Caltech. Great majority of the staff at Radio Physics feel that the radio astronomy program at Radio Physics should become part of the Australian National University.
Was that true?
It's true. Would he take suitable mm-hmm. action? I don't know. This is the rough gist of the gist of the letter. Bob Barker, when I was telling him the story, who's about the most astute scientific administrator is the most astute I've ever run into, and I learned a heck of a lot, and stopped him and said, you don't need to tell me the rest of the story. He said he took that letter and showed it to Taffy. He
right.
said, Gordon, he said, there's one thing you've got to remember. He said, bosses have a union.
right.
And I'm I'm conjecturing now,
yeah.
but to a large extent, but it's pretty clear that was very closely linked in time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think again I'm betraying confidence as when Chris said to me sometime later when he took the job at university. At Sydney University, he said, it hurts like hell to take a job which Ron Brace will turn down.
And Mills's departure, the standard story is that, of course, he wanted yet a bigger
right.
Mills
Same cross. Thing. That came automatically. So the people were isolated. Some of the people were rather weak, I think, personalities.
But now
Paul was the only one who sort of stood outside it for a while. He managed to for a large time, for a long time. But he was on Rosie's side too.
But looking at it from Bowen's point of view, if he had chosen for the larger Mills Cross, then perhaps Kalgura never could have come
right.
along,
right.
and then he would have lost Wilde. I mean, was right. there any real solutionist? I mean, you had these very good, very independent-minded scientists who had long careers in the lab, but was there any way of really keeping them on?
No, I'm older and wiser by now, and I think this is an inevitable fact in the way scientific groups grow. I see it. There's no way of avoiding it that I know of. The only way to break it up a little bit is to have a much stronger administration somewhere further up the line to oversee these things and know that these sort of things inevitably happen.
Yeah.
Men get old, younger men come along.
Yeah.
And, you have to do somehow. That's one of the. I think that's the end of radio physics as well as part of the start of it too. They're all the same age. It had no real mechanism, like a university does, for channeling people through.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the tragedy, I think, of the organization.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. I've also seen it at NRL, for instance.
Right.
Is it also fair to say that the loose organization that you've brought up several times helped to create this kind of situation?
Right. It created a lot of people too independent
and right.
thought they had the strength to survive
right.
by themselves, whereas I'm sure they don't really fully appreciate the lesson that Taffy taught them because there was a death lesson in it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, it's a very grudging sort of an admiration I have.
Let's go back to the New Zealand expedition, which we forgot, which took place in 1948, I believe it was.
Yes.
Can you tell me your recollection of the...
Yes, that's pretty clear. That sprung out of I told you the other day, out of the feeling that, okay, we weren't identifying Cygnus, we had the strongest source. This was the real kicker. I mean, the strongest source we couldn't identify. My hang-up on the extragalactic sources, generally. We knew that the sea interferometer wasn't entirely a reliable way. That was the thing I could not convince John of. I forgot there was one other instrument John suggested, which I killed him off, and this is why we got onto the two-element interferometer. John actually crashed not on the two-element interferometer, but on the idea that Joe should make a super array out of Dover using the sea. And I had absolutely no faith in it because I said we obviously need much more precise measurements. We're not going to do it with the sea interferometer. It's part of Chris's reason for saying they should put a brass plaque on the place, and I agreed with Chris. But unfortunately, the reality of radio physics was that by now Bernie Mills, John, I think, had let this opportunity pass by. Bernie had now established himself as being the spaced interferometer
mm-hmm.
man at radio physics.
Right.
And to get anybody else in this required a considerable expenditure. But Joe had given us the option of getting into that. I felt we should. John felt we should stick with the sea interferometer and build a bigger instrument. But anyhow, let's go. Okay, we're getting a little bit off. I thought you should have that part of the
yes,
story.
Yes, but let me just ask one little question.
That one died fast.
I wasn't quite sure what you meant by, you mean an array at Dover Heights, which would be
a sea interferometer, but a much bigger collecting area, say a paraboloid, a sliced paraboloid. It was never really clearly defined, except, actually, John has the papers on that. I never really saw.
I think I did see a couple of proposals on that when I was going through the archives, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But let me ask another general question to do with this versus the whole Michelson interferometer as was being developed at Cambridge in particular. What did you see as the fundamental advantages and disadvantages of the two at that time?
I didn't see... the only disadvantage I saw to the Michelson was... was the fact that it was more expensive because you had to build two antennas. You had to put some way of varying the space. Well, we didn't know about varying the spacing, although we did have some idea that you took various spacings and you got some diameter information about it. There were more technical problems in building the Michelson interferometer. The C interferometer was a cheap, quicky way of getting on the air, and the big advantage to the C mm-hmm. interferometer was economics. Yeah. If you wanted to get into the game of doing more sources. There was no doubt that the Michelson interferometer, in my mind, was going to beat the C interferometer if we had to do precise positions, and that's why, of course, we went to it. We no longer had the political ties when we were in California, so right. we could embrace the interferometer with open arms.
Was there something that the C Cliff interferometer survived so long in radiophysics because it had been a part of the wartime experience as well as the early radiophysics days, do you think?
We had to get it. You know how fundamental research goes. You have to have a reason before you can get extra money. We barely got, after all, this is only the difference now between 1946 and 1950 we're talking about when the yes. decision had to be made, 4 years.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to talk about big instruments. There's a natural human tendency to let the thing, although I might have felt that we were over the hill, I wasn't convinced that we were. I mean, yeah. I couldn't go to somebody and say, hey, we've got to get out of this, we've got to go.
You weren't pounding the table saying that?
No, I wasn't pounding yeah. the table about it at all.
Yeah.
But I had a sense of depression
yeah.
that it wasn't going to last that much longer.
Okay. Now, back to the New Zealand expedition.
Okay, so that was part of the story, but we also decided that Cygnus wasn't identified. We had to find some other way with the C interferometer to do it. And one of the ways was to watch a source completely through the sky. We didn't have a full understanding of the mathematics of the interferometer at that time, but we knew that at least if we could see the thing rising and setting, we'd have a better chance of determining what the right ascension right. was for a star. And hopefully we could symmetrically predict the interference pattern on either side as it went through the zenith.
Some errors might cancel, was that also part
right,
of
right, right. That was part of the thinking on it as well. So so we were looking for that. We were looking for a north-south, a northerly exposure. And so I dragged out the maps, and I hadn't been back home to New Zealand since we left when I was only 6 or 7. And I looked at the north of New Zealand and said, hey, there's North Cape, and I looked at the elevations. I went down and looked, it's about 300 feet or something like that. Let's go there. I said, be a nice trip, I'd like to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And John, being somewhat bolder than I was at that time when things like that, went to Joe and said, we're going to have an expedition to New Zealand. And Joe, sort of, again, not wanting to be too severe, never wanted to be very severe on anybody, or sort of think about it. And he was going to England, I think, on a trip of the United States for that time. And he took the boat. And the boat to New Zealand has to do a strange thing. There are no harbors on the west coast of New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
You've got sandbars. It has to go all to get to Auckland. It has to go right up around the tip of New Zealand and come down into Waitemata Harbour. Although the West Coast Harbour is only 10 miles away when you get into Waitemata Harbour. So we get a letter back from Joe, and I don't know if that's in the files or whether John got the letter back. And there's a little profile. This is what North Cape looks like.
I see.
I got the equipment to go through it, got a hold of an old army trailer and designed the equipment, and got it on a ship, and I preceded John to New Zealand. It was a big thing in New Zealand. The first time I ran into reporters, I mean, I had a reporter there waiting for the aircraft, and I got rid of him in a hurry. And then they sent up somebody from Alice, I think was the guy's name, from Christchurch. DSI from DSIR in New Zealand to work with us.
Right.
He was a bit of a wild character.
To work with you in what sense? Help with the setting
they,
up?
I think they had some idea. They had some idea that we could educate a New Zealander in radio astronomy, and that might start them. Well, that never came, of course. But, and I don't. I never really heard of him again, although I sent him a note a couple of times at Christmas. But he was a sort of a.
This wasn't a fellow that was advisor or teacher of Alan Maxwell, who I believe, an undergraduate and did an experiment in radio astronomy around 48
or 49. It's a while since I must ask, Al. I haven't seen Alan for a long time.
What was this fellow's name, Allison?
Ellis, I think. Ellis, E-L-L-I-S.
Oh, Ellis.
Ellis.
Well, I'll have to check. I actually have got a copy of this sort of undergraduate thesis that he did. But anyway.
Well, we got to New Zealand, and I got to New Zealand. I did all the preliminary legwork to find out what we could do and where we could go, and I soon found that it was impossible to get to North Cape. I believe it is now possible to get there. There's no roads up there, and you certainly couldn't get a 20-ton trailer over the sort of country they had up there, which was almost desert. So I picked on a site on the east coast of Lee. And Lee is, that area of the east coast of New Zealand is very, very reminiscent of Maine.
Of Maine?
Very, very strongly reminiscent of Maine. At least that harbour in particular. The hills around it are not reminiscent of Maine. They're sort of rolling grassland going into the sea. And the cliff was 900 feet high and looked towards an island group called Little Barrier Island. And it was a sheer fluke. We got the best, it was terrible weather. I think I mentioned that to you the other day. I remember on one occasion going up there at night, and Taurus was rising, the crab was rising at night then. And I remember we had a barometer. We sort of were getting fancy. We decided that we could make refraction corrections if we knew something about the water vapor content in the atmosphere and things like that. But we really, really couldn't. And one of the New Zealand, the government departments in New Zealand got very excited and said, did we want the mean tide height levels and things like that? And I had to act very learned and said, well, yes, I think so. And I think the guy thought I was a bit of an ass. But the whole key to the success of the expedition, or the fact that we were able to get an identification out of it, was that New Zealand had less radio development than Australia. The interference patterns were the cleanest I'd ever seen. We got these beautiful clean interference patterns at 75 megahertz. We stayed at, I was talking about the barometer sitting in the trailer at night there, and I remember watching the darn thing one night. And within the space of half an hour, it dropped, no, 10 minutes actually, it went down half an inch. And then the wind hit my sword, I just hung on to everything. The wind hit the side of the trailer, it was going in and out, like the side of the drum. It was rough weather.
But you say some of the identifications came out of the more accurate positions that you got from New Zealand?
The crab really came out of New Zealand, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now my recollection is not clear enough to say that one of the other sources did. I'm pretty sure Virgo surprisingly came out at Dover Heights. Mm-hmm.
But interference was quite a problem at Dover Heights, are you saying?
Yes, interference was quite a problem.
In the sense that sometimes data was hopeless and other times it was okay, or was it always sort of messing things up?
It wasn't always messing things up, it was sort of in the general level of the noise. I've never really pinned. I couldn't say specifically that interference that I could clearly classify as interference was a major problem, but the noise level of the records was much higher, or noticeably higher, at Dover Heights than it was at the ones I saw in New Zealand.
I see, and that's the only explanation you can think of that as a possible cause.
Yes.
Basically.
Yes, it may be in the conditions in the Australian coast at that latitude, but I think more likely that there was a fairly high low level of interference in the general vicinity of Sydney.
Yeah.
And in Lee, we didn't see this. And we had a wonderful few months.
Did you stay in this trailer? Or
No, we stayed in a hotel. We lived it up in this little old country hotel that had two drunken proprietors. And lived the life of Riley, I think, for a while. We travelled up and down the North Island of New Zealand. I went back to my old hometown of Cambridge. And,
were you both bachelors in those days?
Yes.
Yeah, so you could...
No, John wasn't. John was not. John was married. And the second part of the expedition was Lee.
You went to two sites?
No, Piha. We went to two sites. Uh-huh. The reason I picked the Lee site was that, okay, I said, instead of going to North Cape, I'll pick, New Zealand's very narrow across, and if I can pick another site on the other coast, it doesn't take as much effort to get there. Well, it happened to be there's an old radar station in a place called Piha, which, and I've got pictures of this place.
It's P-I-H-A?
P-I-H-A. It's fairly close to Auckland, and it's on the west coast harbour now of Auckland. And it was on a cliff of much the same height as there was at Lee. So I forget the actual time we were at Lee, but we towed the trailer off. Amid farewells from the farmer, we very cooperative, wonderful people in the area. Although we made a terrible mess of his land as we took the trailer out, and towed it back to Pihar and did the same sort of observations over there again, watching the thing set instead of rise.
Okay, we were up to the point of you going to the States. So you went to Caltech in 1955.
Right.
There was John Bolton was already there?
John preceded me by a few months, yes.
But there was no instruments there at that
Nothing.
Stage?
Not a thing.
So what was the first stage to...
Well, the first stage was... I'm trying to collect my thoughts and say clearly how we arrived at the first stage.
Was there promise of ONR money at that stage?
Sure. Well, the director of the project, actually, there was no real director, but Bob Barker, who was then chairman of the Division for Physics, Mathematics and Astronomy, was in effect running the project, and he did all the time John was there, which was sort of a sore point with John. And Bob had got a promise of ONR money, but not a very large amount of ONR money, and I can't remember the specific amount, but it was barely enough to support myself and John. Mm-hmm. So the problem was to get something on the air, anything on the air, and I had designed the little paraboloid back in Australia, which wasn't little at that time, so
right.
I said, okay, we'll try the same trick again, except this time I'll build it 30 feet, we'll get it up as fast as we can. Before I had come to the United States, so John had done some searching around for sites. And he did have a partial commitment on this, that if he built a site, it had to be within, I think, 150 miles of Los Angeles, or otherwise it increased the running cost by some $20,000 or something like that.
Right.
And ONR wasn't too happy about having that sort of a thing. So he, after looking up and down California, or what he thought was the accessible area of California, decided on a site at Ojai, Santa Barbara, where I live now.
What was the name?
Ojai.
Ojai?
Yeah, it's spelled the Spanish way, O-J-A-I.
O-J-A-I, Ojai.
Right. However, just before I came, he found that it had been selected as a Minuteman site or something like that. What the Navy had it anyhow, was a funny thing, for a classified reason, which he couldn't define. And it wasn't that great a site. It wouldn't have done what I thought it could do, because I had a look at it and it was sort of in a bowl. He could have put up a single antenna, but nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
So together we started off looking again.
And what you were thinking of, a two-dish interferometer, or what were you thinking?
It wasn't thinking... I don't think that John had really any clear idea at that time what specifically he wanted to put up. But you'd have to ask him that.
Yeah, I'm sure I did.
And I really can't say.
You were following his ideas on that sort of thing?
To a large extent, yeah. Yes, that's true. So we started to look for sites again. And we did it together. We traveled up and down. We traveled down out into the desert in the Borrego Springs area. And I was doing a rough sort of a testing with a radio receiver. That went to 100 megahertz, but nothing much more. And it was pretty obvious that none of the sites would do any good, but I thought there was some possibility in the Lake Henshaw area, which was immediately under Palomar, and there were obvious advantages to sort of establishing that area. However, we got down as far as a place called Earthquake Valley, which is right on the Mexican border. It was hot. Oh, God, it was hot. It didn't test badly. I said, well, on our general philosophy, I said to John, I said, I don't think we want this. I said, we can find a more pleasant place than this. So I'll have to tell these stories in parallel because the other thing was going on at another time, or in series rather, but they're running in parallel. he was off to England, and he said, well, he said, keep on looking. He said, I think it was the Ursi meeting, wasn't it? Was that the Dublin Ursi meeting?
Dublin IAU in 55.
Dublin IAU.
That's right.
Yeah, he was off to the Dublin IAU.
Right.
And he said he'd keep on looking. So I had the first employee, well, there were two first employees. One was Johnny Harriman, and the other was an engineer who'd been in the aircraft game, Temple Larrabee. And Temple was an old Californian boy. His father had been a law professor at UCLA, and he knew everything in California. So I went looking further up north, going up the back road, going up through the Inukern over the Mojave Desert, and I got as far as Inukern, which was about the limit of the Navy's specification in distance. And again, I'm in desert, the lowest part of the desert. It's August.
Right.
The temperature is well over 100 degrees. This temple doesn't test too well. I said, I don't like it. There's a Navy missile station over there. He said, well, the Temple had been married twice. He said, I know a place where my wife, my second wife and I had our honeymoon. He said, let's keep on going. So we kept on driving into the Owens Valley and kept on driving up until we got to Big Pine. And I said, let's go inland from there. I said, as soon as I saw the start of the Owens Valley, I said, we've got it. I said, we need space. It's flat, and I'm sure I can get what I want. The earth moving costs will be small. Mm-hmm. We have to do it. And so we drove over the Orange River at Big Pine, and I said, this is close to it. But he said, well, you've got to go one more place. So we went all the way up to Mammoth there, and then looked at a place up there. This is where he'd actually had his honeymoon.
Right.
It was in the Twin Lakes region up there, which is very beautiful, you know. I said, this is great, and there was a wonderful meadow there. And then I, not knowing anything about California, started to make some inquiries and found they had 6-foot snowfalls in the winter. I said, that's out. So we tested the Big Pine site again on the way back. And when John came back in September, he was pretty busy, and I said, I've got him. He said, I'll go up right away. He was going out to a party on that Saturday night. So he drove up and the site, so let's go. And in the meantime, anyhow, the parallel story that I'm telling you in series was the 30-foot. We decided to go ahead with starting something at Palomar just to get our names on the books and get it in the record that we were actually active in the area. So I designed the 30-foot and a 21-centimeter receiver to go with it. Complete 21-centimeter receiver, and we were on the air with that within 6 months and taking records.
Right. Now, was Barry Clark with you by then, or?
Yes. There was a group of Well, Barry Clark had been an undergraduate at Caltech, and he was definitely there. There was no question of that. The problem in the early stages in getting students was that we were not recognized. I mean, we were starting, how do you get students? So to some extent,
and you're competing with Palomar.
Not so much that. We're competing. We wouldn't get Palomar students. They came in to work on Palomar. They're unlikely to be convinced that they want to work in radio astronomy.
That's true.
People who've never built a telescope yet.
Yeah.
But there were people in the physics department, and I think in particular, of the early students, there was Dan Harris and Barry Clark, and then a particular group of three who I felt I never really could decide amongst them. Was Alan Moffat, of course, and Dick Reed,
Ken Kellerman,
and Bob Wilson.
Bob Wilson,
right. Ken came later. He was in the second tier of students, and it's sort of been fascinating to me to see how those three in particular worked out, because it was difficult really to decide amongst them academically. But the differences in their characters, I think, showed up later.
Why was it that you got into 21 centimeter? Neither you nor John Bolton had this in your backgrounds.
Well, for one thing, I never do anything twice.
Okay.
I think that's as good as answer.
Were you interested in the results coming from Holland?
Well, there was no real reason. The real reason to get into 21 centimeters, I suppose, was it was the thing at that time. The line had only been discovered in 1951. I didn't think it was I didn't think that as a research project, we never really thought of it as being very interesting as a research project, but we felt we could publish, there's so much information in the 21 centimeters at that time, we felt we could publish something, whereas we didn't have an instrument which would compete with the instruments which were coming online and continuing.
For eyes, So it was just something that could be done.
The other thing about it was that I had certain ideas about how parabolas should be built after the little one back in Australia, mm-hmm. and then the 30-foot. And also, Temple was an ex, he'd been in aircraft, and this time instead of using tube like I did on that one, Temple said to me, well, let's get an aircraft rivet gun. Temple always thought big and riveted together, so mm-hmm. I got aluminum mm-hmm. angles and riveted the backup structure together, but I was able to try out many of the ideas that we were able to apply to the 90-foot.
So it was a good testing bed for
it was a good test, but for the test bed for the 90-foot.
What was the relationship with the optical astronomers? I mean, Greenstein in particular is the name that comes to mind. Were they behind Barker, pushing him to do this, or was that an independent?
That's an interesting question, and I could my feeling, you know, my feeling always was that Jesse, for one, was not behind it. I felt that. Jesse felt quite comfortable, I think, with what you could get out of the 200-inch telescope, so he didn't. He felt it was an unnecessary complication. I think the people who pushed the radio astronomy at Caltech were Bob Barker, Leda Bridge, and Rudolf Minkowski. I'd say Walter Barter was pretty solidly behind it, too. But besides that, it was sort of somewhat ho-hum. And I think I ran into that problem again later. I felt when I proposed the larger Owens Valley Array, and I got it through all the scientific committees with very high recommendations.
This is now 1970.
Yes, so 1961 was when I proposed that.
Oh, 61.
I've got the proposals at home, I can show you. It was written in 1961.
Really?
1962.
Now, what was this going to be?
This was going to be a five-element array, which is the Owens Valley itself. Although it was a battle between myself and Greenbank, of course, about who was going to build what.
Right.
But I always felt that the idea preceded what went on at Greenbank on the VLA.
That's interesting. So this idea, however, was around for at least 10 years, right? It was competing with, in the early 70s, with or late 60s, with the upgrading of Arecibo and...
Well, sure, that was the whole trouble. Well, see, I got...
So this is the genesis of that idea 10 years earlier.
Well, many people have asked me in the game, why wasn't it finally built? Yes, I wrote the proposal, I wrote two proposals in the Whitford Report, which was the first, it was recommended to be built. If you remember, drag out the Whitford Report, you'll find it number one. It should be built. No mention of large arrays. It was a five element array of 130-foot dishes with the possibility of expansion.
And all movable?
All movable.
Yeah. All movable. And in any case, you were saying that when you did that, you didn't get full support.
I think that's, Jesse, of course, has great strength politically in astronomy. And I felt Jesse was never behind it. Mm-hmm.
But in 55, were you part of the astronomy department?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
Although you say Barker ran the show, and he wasn't really part of it.
I was the first director. He was chairman of the Division of Physics, Mathematics, and Astronomy.
He's over many departments.
Yes, right. He was in charge of astronomy, which I said was of the radio astronomy, which was a sore point with John, and it wasn't until John left that I was appointed director.
Which was what year?
That was in 1960. John had left, actually, and then they appointed me director. I felt I'd inherited a sinking ship because there was nothing had come out, nothing was published.
At that point, yes.
And of course, it didn't look very good when the man who had originally been appointed had just walked out in the show, and I could see the man I owe, I think, most to was Arnold Shostak, who stuck with me.
I had to interview him, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That had to be a gamble on Arnold's part.
Okay, going back to 55, this 30-foot dish we've discussed. But what about the main instrument for Owens Valley?
Okay, well, O&R had never been told that they were going to build two large 90-foot parabolas. So there was, John was good, very good at this. There was some fast footwork, and we talked about it a bit, and said, this is the way it's going to go. I can't remember the chronology of it. It was mainly John's idea on how to go with the two old dishes. I did say to him, I saw the stuff he wrote. I said, what are you buying me? I said, you're asking me to design an instrument where you've got to get positional accuracies on 200 sources to better than half a minute arc. I said, the literature on that is 10 arc minutes, not half an arc minute. I said, you're sticking my neck out from you a long way.
Yeah.
But he wrote it up that way. It was his, the spacings and things like that were John's sole idea and not mine. They got a design study going. Bruce Rule then took over, or rather Charlie Jones Bruce did the initial design and then started the detailed design with Charlie Jones, who did a lot of work for us in various things. We were at the stage where we would go out for bids, and of course the bids, I've got them at home somewhere, and I forget the exact number, what the 90-foot for bid are, way over what the Naval Research was interested in.
Right.
So some fast talking had to be done to sort of get the money out of O&R. And O&R came good. I think they came good with one first, and then they came good with the money for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Foundations came from other sources. The Navy wasn't interested in real estate, so we had to, although some of it, I think, was sort of gotten in by the back door for the foundations. But
And they were built over what period?
The dishes were the first one. The first one became operational late in 1958 because John was getting a bit mad at Bob Barker because he wouldn't let him go and come to me. And I don't think it was that so much because Taffy had, I don't think John was being completely honest about that, because Taffy had offered John at that time, he'd said to John, when the 100 meter goes, you're going to be in charge.
Right.
So I don't know that John was being completely honest when he told me I'm going in 6 months because I can't get on with Bob Barker or something.
Yeah.
But
it also seems very strange for Bolton to have invested that much in developing the whole business, and then, although this was a very good opportunity, but to leave it. Well, you say you were abandoning a sinking ship, but...
Well, he did one thing. When he left, he did this. There had been some work come out of it. There had been some right ascensions, which John, in the last, had worked... Really, for the last 3 months that John was there, and he took some of the right ascensions with him. We hadn't measured a declination at that time. We hadn't attempted. We hadn't put it onto a declination. And John could be annoying when he was on top of the world. He was the most beautiful guy when he was down. I loved John when he was down. And he wrote me this beautiful letter recently, which I appreciated. But when he was on the top, he could be impossible. You know, he has the arrogance of a shy man. He basically is a very shy person. But he handwrote me a list of things. He said, here, you're taking over. He said, if you're lucky, you can stretch this instrument out for 6 months. And somewhere I've got that list written down of the things that I should do for the next 6 months to get that going.
And then drop it.
Yeah. But I wasn't so concerned about that. I knew John, and took that. You know, it's the old syndrome. If I'm going to leave the place,
it can't be worthwhile.
It's not.
But
not gonna
but still,
succeed.
I mean, you say he had done something for 2 or 3 months, but there was a lot of potential there,
right?
Coming along, and I guess.
Well, I told him that. I said to John, "You're mad." I said, "Really, the thing was really he." He really felt strongly about the battle with Pawsey. I said that everybody was on Pawsey's side. John wasn't, but unlike Taffy, John was not a cold person. He was a very emotional, very warm person in his way. And that hurt him emotionally very deeply, and it was a scar he carried all ever since that day he came into my office and said, I'm out of radio astronomy.
Yeah.
And probably carries with him now. I said, why do you want to go back to that for? I said, God's sake, I said, it's an emotional mess. You're walking into something which is going to last more than the lifetime now, the enmity out of what's happened in the last few years, and particularly when you do this.
this.
Yeah.
Big promise on coming back. And I think it was just more of that, sort of rather an unthinking sort of sense of vindication. He would have done a lot better really staying.
Yeah. Okay. What were the results in the first